This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, where we'll be talking about climate hypocrisy.
Don't worry, Mother. It'll be all right.
What, you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't worry, sister. Say your prayers and sleep tight. It'll be fine, lover of mine, it'll be just fine. Lend your voices only to sounds of freedom. No longer lend your strength to which you wish to be free from. Feel lies with love and bravery, and you shall lead a life uncommon. I've heard your anguish, I've heard your heart's cry out. We are tired.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Our guest tonight on the phone will be Sammy Grover. He's written a book with the intriguing title, We're All Climate Hypocrites Now. We'll ask him to clarify that claim and tell us who exactly are these hypocrites. We also want to help him. He wants to help us. See ways out of that hypocrisy.
Okay. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by All Electric Motion, Chico's exclusively electric bike and transport store, offering an eco-friendly and convenient way to get around town. All Electric Motion is open from 10 a.m. until 6 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday, offering test rides on commuters, step-throughs, and trikes in the Garden Walk Mall at 225 Main Street in downtown Chico. To schedule a test ride or rental, call 530-774-2067. And Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of all of you and by Friends of Butte Creek, presenting the 15th Annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival on November 20th at the Arc Pavilion on Park Avenue, and virtually from November 20th through Thanksgiving. Tickets for both the live and virtual events at buttecreek.org. Friends of Butte Creek, protecting and restoring the watershed for over 20 years. The opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. We are going to take a little break here, and we'll be back to talk with Sammy Grover.
We're having a little difficulty reaching our guest, Sammy Grover. We'll play a little music and hope that we can find Sammy at home in Durham, North Carolina.
When really you've only just arrived, I caught first glimmers and hides and skins. Look who's all grown up, black swanning about the solar winds. You're gonna lose it all and find yourself on your knees. So get a grip and you might flow, reverse the great slow bleed. I've tried patience, but you always want a war. This house won't tolerate anymore. Stop this right away.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Our guest tonight is Sammy Grover, who has written a book from New Society Publishers with the intriguing title, We're All Climate Hypocrites Now, and with the subtitle, How Embracing Our Limitations Can Unlock the Power of a Movement. He has studied at Hull University in England and Copenhagen University, and now lives in Durham, North Carolina. He has worked in communications with Larry's Beans, Burt's Bees, and the Canaan Fair Trade, among others.
Sammy freely acknowledges his past and present as a do-gooder. He says he's been a do-gooder for 30 years and says he has a, quote, unhealthy obsession with human waste and what we should be doing with it. The book is both lighthearted and deadly serious. We're pleased to welcome Sammy Grover.
Hey, nice to be here.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's plunge right in with your title. What do you mean by saying we're all climate hypocrites? Who, us?
Well, the example I give is one in my own life, right? Is that I, about, 17 years ago now, I vowed never to fly again. I was concerned about my carbon footprint. I wanted to make a change for the better, and I promptly fell in love with a woman on the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, great.
I've been flying regularly and feeling terrible about it ever since. But I think a lot of folks I know and a lot of folks listening to this show are probably familiar with the predicament, right? Is that we would quite like to move beyond a world of fossil fuels, yet we have no choice but to live within a world of fossil fuels. And we, meaning those of us that have sort of achieved or been blessed with a certain level of economic and material well-being, almost inevitably find ourselves in a position where we have an outsized carbon footprint, and the values we purport to hold come into tension with the lifestyle we end up leading.
Yes.
We do want to give a shout out to one of our local gadflies, a guy named Patrick Newman. We've had him on the show. Patrick writes to the newspaper regularly to remind us of our hypocrisy. People, he says, who are spouting green ideology and then fly to Europe to take a boat cruise up and down the Danube. So thank you, Patty, for calling us out, and thank you, Sammy. We're quite with you in both recognizing our own hypocrisy and the guilt that goes along with it. A lot of your book is talking about how guilty should we feel at this point. And you particularly write about guilt and shaming that has been associated with the green movement. How do those enter into the discussion?
Well, in terms of how guilty we should feel, my own personal answer to that, let me back up. When I started writing this book, I thought the purpose of it was to help us move beyond guilt. I thought if we start looking at this as more of a systemic issue and move a little bit past this idea of individual responsibility or individual behavior change. It allows us to let go of some of that eco-guilt or eco-anxiety you're talking about. I actually ended up moving away from that position, right? Writing a book is a great way to discover you're wrong. And what I ended up, where I ended up landing is that we should feel just about as guilty as it's useful. And I think guilt has this, and shame are these really powerful social regulators. And it's probably healthy that those of us that, have a certain amount of comfort and an outsized carbon footprint do feel guilty when we drive to the store when we could have walked or biked. Right? Or when we, you know, spend 10 minutes in the shower. It's not bad necessarily to feel that twinge of maybe we could make a change. Where I think it becomes unhelpful is when that guilt becomes debilitating. So that's kind of the distinction I make, is that actually a lot of the things I do come out of some form of guilt. But it doesn't necessarily follow that the fact that I have an outsized carbon footprint means the most effective place I can make a difference is in cutting that carbon footprint. What I argue in the book is that rather than starting there, the best thing we can do is find the greatest, the place where we have the greatest power to influence positive change. So by that, I mean beyond my own carbon footprint out in society. Now, it's not bad to also do those things that, that cut your carbon at home, but that's not necessarily where each of our sort of greatest superpower lies.
So I'm thinking about my own guilt because, yes, we do fly. We haven't flown since COVID, but we do fly, and we do still drive gas vehicles, and then we do minor things. But so I'm having problems, but some, you know, this is kind of always the, what is it, the... I can't think of the phrase for there are people that are so much worse than I am, you know. Right. And I think about you know, things like just buying new clothes every season, you know, or buying an extra pair of shoes when you have plenty of shoes if you just wear, you know, if you just have these two pair, one for winter and one for summer. And so I don't know if that's useful to me or not. It does put me in the position of being pretty judgmental. And so that doesn't seem really useful. I judge myself as well, but I also judge those people that are worse than I am. So
that's definitely something where I argue that we need to be quite careful about, is sort of distinguishing one between guilt and shame and shaming, and then thinking about how those function. So a lot of this is not my own original work. I spoke to a lot of really interesting people during the writing of the book. One of those folks was Jennifer Jackway, who is a professor at New York University, and she's the author of a book called Is Shame Necessary? And she argues that shame and shaming have gotten kind of a bad rap, and that actually they're really useful within the environmental movement. But the trouble is that shaming in particular is a limited resource. Right, the more you use it, the more it loses its power. So if we go around shaming each other for every little transgression or every, you know, every perceived sort of act that is outside of what would be considered a, you know, quote unquote, good environmentalist, we end up diluting the power of that shame, much like you do with antibiotics. If you use them when they're not needed, they then lose their power when you find out that you actually do need them most. So every time we're pointing the finger at each other for, you know, driving to the store or eating that hamburger that maybe we could have chosen differently, that's time not spent shaming Joe Manchin. And I'd much rather spend time shaming Joe Manchin or the CEO of Shell. So thinking about it tactically and strategically as well as morally, I think is a really important thing for us to do.
But you still think those individual efforts are valuable. I mean, you know, getting solar panels if you can, or composting instead of putting things into the garbage, that those have meaning? And then we'll go on to talk about the bigger
issues. I think they have meaning both personally, right? I do a lot of those things just because I enjoy them, right? I have a bucket of worms in my basement, and I love them. They're the only pet that I love. I don't have other pets, I should say. Otherwise, I'm going to be a terrible person. They absolutely have meaning on a personal level. I mean, having having argued to not sweat the small stuff in many of the things I write, I regularly walk on the beach and pick up trash. Mm-hmm. And I don't do that with any delusion that it's actually going to solve the ocean plastics crisis. I do that because it's meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. But the second place where those things have meaning is where they become acts of strategic mass mobilization. And by that, I mean if we can think about those actions we take more like boycotts rather than behavior change. So the example I would give is the Flugscam or the flight shame folks in Europe. What they've managed to do very successfully is take individual action and turn it into a collective movement that is then putting real pressure on the aviation industry, real pressure on legislators, and you're beginning to see shifts in what's available to folks as a result. So you're now seeing sleeper trains between Stockholm and Berlin for the first time in years. You're seeing new routes open up, and you're seeing increasingly restrictions on aviation or talk about taxes and the inclusion of aviation within national carbon plans and that kind of thing. And what I think is interesting is that context is everything in that key. It's a much easier movement to kick off in Sweden, right, or in Germany, where you have viable alternatives available to you, than it is in many parts of the U.S. where the rail system has been systematically dismantled. So again, much like it's important to think tactically and strategically about the role of shame and guilt, it's also important to think tactically and strategically about the context in which you're living and think about what are those realistic things that we can do together. And while I encourage any North American not to fly when they can or avoid a flight, and I do so myself fairly regularly, is sort of get flights where I can or choose telepresence or whatever, I also think we have to be realistic about which actions are actually going to catch on in the populace. And if we're telling people they can't fly home to see their family at the holidays or whatever, that's a pretty high bar to ask of people to join our movement. Mm-hmm. And my position would be that let's start with the low-hanging fruit first. If we want to tackle aviation emissions in North America, let's tackle business travel. Let's tackle all the unnecessary flights that happen for that, because not only is there a lot of them, but they're also the most profitable for the airline industry. So once you start reducing unnecessary business travel, a lot of flights become essentially commercially unviable, and you start to see other alternatives emerge. So again, it's all about, I think this is a line from Mary Hegler, who's a climate essayist and podcaster, does some terrific work, but she was asked at a panel about what the single most important thing you can do as an individual. And her response, which I love and I wish I had thought of, is the single most important thing you can do as an individual is to stop thinking about yourself so much as an individual. Mm. I think that has real power in terms of how you frame your efforts. And if we can think of ourselves not as on this individual journey to get our own carbon footprint to zero, but rather on a collective journey to bring down the only carbon footprint that matters, it shifts where we place our focus and what we choose to do with our time and our resources.
Can that be a cop-out?
Yes.
which can part? Also be. Lost you both.
I have a friend that says it doesn't matter what I do. It's all the big corporations and all the big money and all the big the big groups that are doing the polluting. So it doesn't matter one bit what I do.
Yeah, I absolutely think that can be a cop-out. And I think it's one of those things that has become sort of an overcorrection. Right, I think for the longest time, the environmental movement, largely because of sort of forces outside of our control, sort of gave up on or reduced our focus on legislative change and societal change, and instead focused on these individual footprints. And there was a healthy shift back in the other direction to say, hey, hold on, systems make a difference as to what human beings choose to do. We can't simply expect individual action to get us there. But the overcorrection has come when you then get people throwing up their hands and saying, well, hey, it's all Exxon's fault. Mm-hmm. I have no agency in this at all. And I think absolutely that's not true either. There's there's this middle ground that we can walk where we say we're not expecting perfection. Perfection isn't even necessarily useful within this context, but we all have places where we can start making a difference.
I'll just mention, too, that many of the people we've had on this program, we've asked them, Can we depend on politicians to make a difference? And an overwhelming number of them said, no, it's going to be individual and group actions. They were all good greenies, and they'd kind of given up on the political process. You're suggesting something a little bit different. Yeah, and we want to talk later in the show about political actions going on at the moment.
I think we will also say it needs to start at the local level. It needs to be communities that work together to solve problems locally that then reach out to globally. But I'm not being interviewed right now. You are.
We're both talking a lot tonight.
So how did Green lose its groove? How has it lost political power to, you know, kind of the focus on people need to do better?
Well, the example I look at in the book, and this is, again, based on the writings of a lot of other good folks. I think Kate Yoder wrote a really interesting article for Grist about this, is Earth Day. And Earth Day, when it originally started in the 70s, it was really modeled on the civil rights movement. It was very much focused on mass mobilization, on collective action, on bringing people together to shift systems. There was discussion of these really sort of forward-thinking topics like environmental justice, environmental racism, all of these things. And then you kind of hit the 80s, and the 80s, as we all know, had a very strong individualistic vibe, right? You know, we saw that in the UK with Thatcher, you saw it with Reagan over here, and it really diluted people's faith in collective action and faith in our ability to get sort of political systemic change. And I think a lot of people made a fairly logical or at least understandable conclusion. They said, well, if I can't shift the systems, it feels too big. Where can I make a change? And there's this really alluring thing where maybe we don't have control over those big things, so we move to where we have agency, which is I can make a shift in my own day tomorrow. I can choose to be a vegetarian. I can choose to ride my bike. I can choose to compost. And there's a truth to that, and I think there is a power to that, but there is also an illusion to that because it can feel like we're making this big difference in our own life. Meanwhile, if all of our neighbors carry on as if nothing has changed, I think there's a danger that we are more interested in our own absolution than we are in creating those systemic shifts that are required to make a difference.
You also talk about the role of big business in this and suggest that Big Oil loves to talk to you about and have you think about your carbon footprint. Tell us how that factors into both guilt and how people can react to current climate issues.
Well, it's another example, right, and this is another one where you have to be careful in what you say, because actually there's a version of this, a little like the, you know, 100 companies are destroying the planet and none of it's my fault. There's a statement that goes around that BP invented the carbon footprint. And that's not actually true. BP didn't invent the carbon footprint, but they did help to popularize it. And that's because it suits them very well to have a conversation about we should all turn down the thermostat and ride our bike to the store, largely because they know most people aren't going to actually do it. And the time spent having that discussion is time not spent having a discussion about the huge amount of incentives or tax breaks or all the other support that goes to the oil industry, and or a discussion about actually placing a tax on their products or banning gas-powered cars or these other systemic changes that would really move the needle.
So can you give us some other examples that are like that, of kind of that guilt-inducing greenwashing,
I mean, you see it a lot in terms of the ways that people seek to discredit activists. Right? I don't remember, I think it was probably 3-4 years ago when there was the kayaktivists blocking a oil tanker coming out of one of the West Coast ports. I forget where it was now. And so much of the discussion, both from fossil fuel groups and also from your average internet troll, was essentially, well, you do know that those kayaks are made from oil. And it's such a frustrating argument because of course we do. Right.
Yeah.
And we've all heard it, right? When every time I write an article about climate change, someone says, well, you know that your computer is powered by fossil fuels. And honestly, you know, I think I'm not supposed to swear on the radio, but there is a response to that, which I think is entirely appropriate. And it begins with B and ends with S.
Okay.
You know, it's one of those efforts where if we lean too heavily into this idea of personal purity or sort of gatekeeping around who gets to call themselves an environmentalist, we're really handing an assist to people that would rather nothing changes. Because ultimately, as we said at the start of this conversation, right, we're all forced to interact within this system. we're all forced to sort of go about our daily lives within this system. And honestly, we all make choices that are suboptimal some of the time, but that doesn't negate our desire to move forward, and it doesn't negate the argument that we would all be better off if we started placing very real restrictions on the use of fossil fuels.
I have a thought experiment. Not really. It's a real life experiment. But there is a very popular brewery in Chico, and they're very, the family that runs it is very sustainability oriented. They give a lot of money to the to sustainable issues. Their plant is, you know, everything is recycled. Everything is
99%.
99%, and so it's,
so they say.
It keeps a really, really holds a really, really high standard, but the water, and we lived in here in drought prone California, where we have wildfires and no water, the water that's used in making beer has a huge impact on the water use in our area. So, do you think about ways of weighing those kinds of things, or and you know, beer isn't superfluous, I guess, to some people, but it is a luxury. Well, not really. So how do you think about that?
Well, firstly, I'm English enough to consider beer somewhat of a necessity. But
there are a lot of people who feel that way, actually.
I think it's very important for us to think, and I'm not speaking to this specific example.
No, that's fine.
Named the brewery, and I don't know enough about their operations, but I think it is important in situations like that to recognize that no single organization can solve that. Water in particular is one of those issues where the whole of the West is going to have to figure out where water is going to come from and what is what is a acceptable use of water and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's realistic to ask a brewery to not use water. So we end up in a position where we have to say, do we allow breweries in our community, or do we import beer from elsewhere? It's sort of almost inevitably
yes,
a systemic
right. yeah.
issue. And it yeah. sounds like what that brewery is doing is seeking to make change where they can, mm-hmm. where they have power, and also accepting mm-hmm. that certain things are sort of outside their power. Mm-hmm. And one of the arguments I use in the book is obviously that businesses in particular, just like individuals, can learn to think beyond their own carbon footprint, right, and beyond their own operation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important, as someone who's run my own business and is now employed at another sort of socially conscious social enterprise,
yes.
It's very important to think about those things in your own operations that you can change, right? I had a meeting today about whether we're going to be flying after the pandemic and, you know, what we're going to be doing about our offices and all of those things. But those conversations can only take us so far. And if we're going to get us to a point where we're going to cut carbon as fast as we know the science tells us we need to, then businesses, just like individuals, have no choice but to also engage on the systemic level and raise our voice for political action, both on the local level and on the national and international level. Mm-hmm. And that means coming together with other business people. It means sometimes advocating for things that might be, for things that might be against our own direct, immediate self-interest, right? We probably need to be taxed more every time we fly. That's not good for my bottom line, but at least if everyone else is mm-hmm. being taxed more every time we fly, we are on a level playing field and we're moving society where it needs to go.
Let's take a very brief break to tell our listeners this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And we're talking with Sammy Grover. He's the author of We're All Climate Hypocrites Now. He's also, I've learned, author of over 2,000 articles on Tree Hugger. So he's been a very vigorous writer about environmental issues. What we want to do, we've talked a little bit about the major thesis of the book, but let's talk a little bit more about the subtitle of your book, How Embracing Our Limitations Can Unlock the Power of a Movement. We'd really like to hear more about how we can involve ourselves fruitfully in various kinds of public and political action.
Sure. So I think the subtitle is important there, right? Is that, you know, accepting we're all hypocrites is fine, but, like, what do we do with that information?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think the purpose of the original title. Let's start with the title. The purpose is to disarm this accusation of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. If we all accept that we all have some level of disconnect or tension between where we'd like to get to and where we actually find ourselves right now, that frees us up to say, okay, where can I make the biggest difference? And often where you can make the biggest difference isn't necessarily where you have to make the greatest effort. I think sometimes the environmental movement spends too much time valuing or focusing on the things that feel hard. The example I'll give is finance, right? There's a campaign in the UK called Make My Money Matter. And they came out with this really interesting statistic that moving your pension fund from a regular, you know, pension fund that invests in fossil fuels to a pension fund that is focused on renewables and, you know, sort of an ethical pension fund, if you like, will have 21 times the difference of stopping flying, giving up meat, and choosing an electric car.
Wow.
Something like that. Right? It's crazy, 21 times. Now, I can't speak to their methodology. I'm not going to advocate that their numbers are exactly right, but I think it's an interesting example because we value giving up the car more than we do moving our pension fund, because moving our pension fund is easy.
Yeah.
My argument is, let's start with the things, firstly, that are going to have the biggest impact, and preferably the ones that are actually the easiest to do, because we can bring the most people along with us.
And do you think it's widely known by people who are suffering from guilt what the alternative ways are of having the greatest impact? Do you think...
I don't think it is. I think a lot of us struggle with that because it's really hard to think through, you know, the challenge of anything to do with carbon, right, is it touches every single aspect of our lives. And often what we end up seeing is these sort of lists of 50 things you can do to save the planet.
Exactly.
And they range from relatively meaningful actions to utterly pointless.
Yeah.
And it sort of flattens things that shouldn't be flattened. And what I think we need to do is, one, really focus our efforts. Actually, my colleague at Tree Hugger, Lloyd Alter, has published an interesting book called Living the 1.5 Degree Lifestyle, which is a very different book. It's really focused on cutting his own carbon as much as possible. And what he found is things that are actually very compatible with what I'm arguing too, is that really there's three, four areas of your life you need to focus on, and everything else kind of doesn't matter. Don't worry about unplugging that phone charger or even turning out the lights if you've got LED bulbs. Mm-hmm. You need to tackle your diet, your travel, and your energy use, your source of energy at home, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's this element of overwhelm when we look at this idea of we've got to do all of these things at once, right? We've got to crawl around on our hands and knees, caulking the sideboards, and also give up the car and figure out how to get the kids to school on a cargo bike. And, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. And what I argue is that's fine. If that's what you want to do, if that brings you meaning and power, I celebrate you. And I love those people that are doing that. But I also think there are plenty of people who don't necessarily want to go down that route, but maybe they have this one thing they can do, and they can do really well, and they can keep going that one thing, right? So maybe your compost is your thing, and you want to start a composting program at your school, and then you want to teach the next school to do a composting program. What you will find is through that route, you will end up having an impact that is many times your own carbon footprint for the positive. And I think it's just as valid to go down that route and really forget about whether you flew home to see mom at Christmas or, you know, flew to Sonoma for a good glass of wine. I don't actually care that much about the sort of the scorecard that everyone's keeping. Mm-hmm. I care about the role each of us plays in moving all of us towards a more sustainable future.
Could we talk about examples of that, perhaps? You write, individual action matters more as a path to influence and cultural impact than for its ability to radically cut carbon in and of itself, which you just sort of said for us. You write about Amsterdam and bicycles as one example of how the kind of cultural change you're talking about has taken place. Could you explore that with us, please?
Sure thing, yeah. So I'm sure many of your listeners have flown to Amsterdam.
We have.
And it's a beautiful city. It's a beautiful city. It's one of my favorite cities in the world. And you walk out in Amsterdam, or Copenhagen for that matter, and what you'll see is just thousands and thousands of bicycles, and they're kind of swarming in and out of Central Station. They've got 3-4-story bike parking facilities. It all feels like utter chaos, and yet somehow it works. And it's really easy to forget when you see that it wasn't always that way, right? In the 60s and 70s, actually, the car was taking over Amsterdam just like it was every other city, and canals were being paved over.
Oh, my
and
God.
Bicyclists were being pushed out of the city. And it was really, it was sort of hit or miss whether the biking culture that had been such a part of it was gonna stick around. And what happened is, actually, there was the oil embargo caused temporary halt in the flow of oil to the Netherlands, which then brought about political actions such as a ban on driving on Sundays. And folks kind of pounced on that opportunity. And what you saw is a really broad coalition of people doing a lot of interesting, different things to push back and really reclaim space from the private motor car. So you saw folks that were taking relatively radical action, right? There was a group called Provo, which was sort of an anarchist slash sort of performance theater group that was doing all kinds of fun things like asking motorists to turn off their engine and giving them a push instead, or hitching cars.
Oh my God, I love that.
And all of this kind of stuff. There were other groups that were literally pushing illegally parked cars into the canals. But there were also historic preservationists, and there were also families that were interested in road safety. And it was this really broad coalition that came together to push back and reclaim space. And there were pro-bike parties winning seats on the city council. And all of those folks ended up having their own impact that shifted Amsterdam in a different direction. And now you've got this situation where nearly everybody bikes, and they bike because it's simply the cheapest, funnest, easiest way to get around town. Most people don't even think about biking as an identity or as sort of a political statement or anything else. It's just what you do because it's much faster than driving and much cheaper. I can talk about this all day because I love that city. But the other thing that I think is interesting, when I first found this story, I thought the moral of the story was that we all need to work together, right? And there was this coalition that all came together and they all held hands and they all created this change. And actually, I'm not sure that's true either. I have a hard time picturing some of those historic preservationists sitting down with punk rockers that were pushing cars into canals. What the real moral of the story is that we're all just part of a bigger ecosystem of actors, and we have to directly coordinate with some, and we have to also trust that sometimes someone else is working on a different part of the problem, and we might not even get along, but they might have a valid place, and we have a little bit of humility as to what our role is within that broader social change.
I was about to ask if there was a single group that led the Amsterdam Revolution. It sounds like there wasn't. You just had groups working in parallel and in sync, but no central leadership calling all these groups together.
That is my understanding, and that's the impression I get. I think there are other folks that are much more knowledgeable on this. There's Chris Brunt, who I talked to in the book. He's written some fantastic, he and his wife have written some really terrific work on the lessons of sort of Dutch cycling and the Dutch cycling wars, if you like. But my impression is, it's more of sort of there was a moment in time and there was a cultural shift. And there were really big organized groups, but there were also a lot of individual actors within that. I know there was a group called Stop de Kindermoord, excuse my terrible Dutch accent, but it essentially means stop the murder of children. And it was this really interesting, when I say it's not good to shame or not good to point the finger, I think that's an interesting counterpoint, because what they're saying is driving cars is murder. You know, that's a pretty moralistic argument. But that worked to a certain degree. So I think there's all of these roles for different people to play with different voices, different tactics, and they all somehow move towards this space where suddenly cars didn't make sense anymore on Dutch streets.
One of the issues that's big in Chico right now, and I think this is an issue for all of the West, land use issues and urban sprawl, and we are fighting currently a development of almost 15,000 acres that will have 2,777 houses on it out in pristine oak woodland riparian area. And the city in its general plan calls for infill density, but the money and the power is all on the side of the people who want this beautiful urban sprawl park-like place way out from the city, not cyclable. And so, you know, we're continuing to argue for places that are cyclable, walkable, and using European cities kind of as a model.
Yes.
But the West is just gotten used to sprawl and has gotten used to using all of the wide open spaces. And I think it's true in the Midwest as well. It's only a handful of cities that really use density and see the value in it. So that's a statement, but maybe there's a question.
I had a question, and that was, are there examples of U.S. cities? And I was thinking Durham, North Carolina, is a pretty hip place. And there must be a lot of cultural shift going on there. Are there examples close to home or elsewhere in the U.S. that you can describe for us?
That are densifying and, yeah.
Or yeah, undergoing the cultural
shift. Undergoing a cultural shift, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely see that sort of density happening in pockets around here. So certainly there's a lot of density. You know, I was actually talking with my daughter today about all the apartment buildings going up around her school and having a discussion about, you know, the pros and cons of that. You know, it's driving up prices and a lot of people are being pushed out of the city center. So there's a lot of discussion there too. But there is a contingent that really likes to live downtown in these small to mid-sized cities. We're actually seeing Raleigh is just putting in a lot of separated bike lanes. Chapel Hill is too. Durham, if anyone from Durham is listening, it would be really nice if we got on board because we like our friendly rivalries in the Triangle. But I think that's terrific. I think Pittsburgh has done a lot on biking in particular. So there are sort of pockets and examples. I know out west there's a lot of places that are beginning to look at bans on natural gas, right? And even I forget the city, but there's somewhere that's talking about banning new gas stations, which I think is sort of these terrific pockets of progress. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's any single city that I would hold out that's nailed it, mm-hmm. right? But I don't know if there's any country I would hold up as having nailed it either. I think we sort of see examples of what's going to need to happen all over. And we need to sort of, it's a terrible analogy, but we sort of need to step on the gas with all of them in all these places.
Step on the pedal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You alluded to it earlier, income disparity. Can people with low incomes, people of minorities, people living in dense areas of the city who are in a state of poverty, can they participate in the movement, or are they priced out? Is this something that only the progressives and the wealthy can afford?
Well, I would possibly reframe it as saying, can we learn from populations and movements that have a longer history of fighting injustice? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really interesting work going on within sort of the environmental justice movement and focus on environmental racism. I think one of the interesting kind of tensions in this discussion about carbon footprint is, on the one hand, the wealthiest and the most privileged have the most work to do in terms of cutting their carbon footprint.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The wealthier you are, the higher your carbon footprint is going to be on average. But also a lot of the solutions being pushed, whether that's a Tesla or solar panels or, you know, a passive house or increasingly, you know, downtown living, all of those things are becoming increasingly expensive. So how do we build a movement that not only has place for frontline communities, low-income communities, people of color, all of those folks, but actually takes its leadership from those from communities that know more than, quite frankly, a fairly white mainstream environmental movement that hasn't had to face adversity about how to bring about systemic change or create political a political movement.
We're going to shift gears here just a little bit to Glasgow and Biden. We would welcome your appraisal. I'm sorry, I Glasgow talks about one solution for the poor is for the countries that can afford it to put out some money to fight global war, not only to fight global warming, but to do reparations or to build seawalls around countries that are going to sink if as global warming continues. Could you give us a little bit of your appraisal of Glasgow, and maybe we can relate that to large movements?
I can give you as good an appraisal as I can, with the caveat that I'm neither a climate scientist nor a political expert. Mm-hmm. My position on Glasgow is I think we have to be very careful about how we talk about it. Because on the one hand, there's a lot to really celebrate about the progress that our movements have made. Right? I think it is significant that fossil fuels were mentioned for the first time in a COP agreement. Mm-hmm. I think it's significant that we've at least beginning to have discussion about what was going to be phasing out of coal, and now it's phasing down of coal, you know, all of those sort of wordsmithing. But progress has been made, and progress has not been made anywhere near fast enough. Mm-hmm. Right? And what that means is, on the one hand, we can celebrate the work that we have done, and we can also point the finger and say, this is disgustingly inadequate given the crisis that we're facing as a species, right? And given the fact that those who have contributed least to the problem stand the most to lose. So you've got entire nations that essentially stand to lose their homes, lose their mm-hmm. land, be displaced. And the majority of these nations and the majority of people within these nations have both historically and today minute carbon footprints compared to wealthy nations. Mm-hmm. So absolutely there's a moral imperative to essentially, one, cough up so that we can yes. pay for adaptation and for resilience and for reparations, and two, to keep the damn fossil fuels in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very evident to me, speaking to folks that are much more knowledgeable on this than me, that what came out of COP26 is nowhere near enough, and also is much better than what came out of Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm going to speechify just a bit. I think a huge error was made in describing Glasgow initially as our last and only best chance. And now the story is, yes, it's a pretty good compromise, but not enough. And I think it was oversold in the beginning as a crisis. And in fact, it's part of a sliding scale of actions, not a be-all or end-all. So, end of my speech. I think there were rhetorical errors that make people tend toward giving up. If Glasgow didn't achieve salvation for the Earth, what the hell? What are we going to do next? Forget about it. End of speech.
Yeah, I think one of those things, you all are probably familiar with the book, All We Can Save, right? And I think it's a terrific book, but it's also sort of, I think it's one of those places where I've heard this argument that we're not going to reach a point, one, we're not going to reach a point where we're going to solve this issue, right? There's no version of this where I go to my grave and climate change has been mm-hmm. solved. Yes. This is going to be with us for generations, probably hundreds, if not thousands of years. And every ounce of carbon we cut is going to make a difference as to how much suffering there is in the world, and how much joy there is in the world, mm-hmm. and how much resilience there is in the world, and who gets to enjoy it. So I think you're right on one level, and then I think I also have a lot of empathy for folks who are, on the short term, trying to get policy wins and victories. So we're in this really difficult place where we have to say things like, we've got 10 years to cut our carbon in half.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But if we get there, in 10 years' time, we may find that we haven't reached that, and we're going to have to find a new slogan. Fortunately, people have the memory of a goldfish half the time, and we can move on to another slogan, mm-hmm. right?
What about the Biden packages? Do you see anything optimistic about? Well, we're still squabbling over that whole thing, but are there things that are hopeful with our government taking some major actions?
You know, one of the things that I was most hopeful about, and I'm talking here about the Build Back Better package, which is still yes. the one that's sort of in limbo right now.
Right.
Yes.
But as it currently stands, I believe there's tax credits in there for e-bikes. And I'm not under any illusion that e-bikes are going to solve climate change. I'm not advocating that in any way. But what I thought it was an interesting example of is at least a little more nuance in how we talk about discussions, because it makes zero sense that we give folks who are buying a Tesla, you know, $7,000 or $12,000 or whatever it is as a tax break, and yet we have these tools that are really very affordable and can replace a car for many, many people, and we give it zero policy support. So if we look at it as an example of, hey, maybe if we thought a little more nuanced and a little more detailed about all the different solutions, we may find all these places where actually we can make a much bigger difference than simply throwing money at these big ticket kind of sexy, for want of a better word, projects and products.
In the few minutes that we have left here, the final chapter of your book is devoted to resources, organizations, and actions. So what is your call to action, and who's out there to help?
So my call to action is probably to start with finding community, right? So find the area of this that resonates with you the strongest, and ideally, and often is the case, that it also happens to be that what lines up with your strength, your interest and your opportunities, right? And then find community around that. So it might be political activism. There are terrific groups like, you know, the Sunrise Movement, 350.org. I'm on the board of Dogwood Alliance, so I always give a shout out to Dogwood Alliance, which focuses on forests in the Southeast United States. But it's almost like, and I say this sort of half joking, but the encouraging thing about the climate crisis is it's so all-encompassing that you're not short of places to start. There are all, you know, if food is your thing, go find a group that's working on food policy and agriculture. If human waste is your thing, start there, right? But find that one thing and then dig deep into that, and find community. It doesn't have to be political action. It might be, like we said earlier, sort of starting a composting committee at your school, or
tree planting,
a bike co-op, or whatever those things are. But really starting to think more in terms of, where can you deploy your skills and bring other people along on the journey? It's a much stronger place to start than just a fret over every single part of your own personal lifestyle.
I wanted to, I'm sorry, I was blanking out briefly. I was thinking about something else. I wanted to say the book itself is really challenging, and it goes in multiple directions, and it's given me a pause about a lot of things. I was going to mention, to ever so briefly, we just heard from about Bill McKibben has a new group called Third Act, which appeals to some of us who are seniors. And his notion there is that a lot of folks from the 70s are pretty much burned out and looking for a place to land for actions that will make a difference in their declining years. And so that's another group where some of us graybeards can
I love that, because I think there's a lot of talk about sort of the teen activism and youth activism that's going on. It's really terrific what is going on, but I worry sometimes that it gets framed as this sort of generational battle, and it's really not a battle of generations. It's a battle of class and of power. And I think so that sort of, if we can move beyond this idea that it's sort of kids versus boomers or, you know, whatever which it never was and never will be, and instead start saying, well, actually, there are a lot of people. If I go to a climate protest, there are two groups that are usually overrepresented, right? And it's young kids, and then it is like older folks, retirees who have time. You've got the raging grannies showing up, and those folks are really like, you know, they've got both wisdom and often resources and time. And those things are exactly what the movement needs. And if we can bring kind of the two ends of the generational spectrum together, and then those of us in the middle can just sort of, well, we can just relax. Now, we'll follow along and help where we can.
This has been Ecotopia on KZFR. We want to thank our guest, Sammy Grover. He challenged us, but he's also given us some ways to not only resolve our guilt, but to take significant actions. The book is We're All Climate Hypocrites Now. It's published by one of our favorite publishers, New Society Press. Thank you, Sammy, for being with us on Ecotopia tonight.
Hey, thank you. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was fun for us, too. Thanks.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We found that a stimulating discussion with Sammy Grover. Again, the book is We're All Climate Hypocrites Now, and published by New Society Press. Coming up in just a few minutes, it's North State Give and Take. Bobby Tryon will be interviewing Claudia Lang of the Centerville Coleman Museum. Also at 6:30, then, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive.
So stay with KZFR all evening. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs. Plus, we have an ever-growing list of resources. It's huge by now, so you really should go there and check it out.
I have to say, if you're writing a term paper for your high school science class, our resources page does
got
the work for
you. Yeah. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. And we also welcome your comments and suggestions. Please send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
North State Give and Take is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923. And by The Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment.